are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider, featuring book reviews authored by critics from the New York Times. The Power of Parting: Finding Peace and Freedom Through Family Estrangement, by Eamon Dolan. The book cover is blue with six yellow silhouetted birds sitting on a wire. One of the birds is flying up and away from the others. The reviewer is Alexandra Jacobs. When cutting ties is the best thing a child can do. In The Power of Parting, Eamon Dolan makes a persuasive case for eliminating contact with family members whose abusive behavior can't be redeemed. There is a picture of two painted faceless figures. One is a woman holding the hand of a man, but the hand is broken off while the man is walking away without it. It was sometime during the bottomless scroll of quarantine that I started seeing the phrase no contact, not referring to social distance measures, but a drastic way to end relationships with nettlesome exes or even one's parents. I found it even more chilling than the now canonical term ghosting. With ghosts, at least there's a faint outline, perhaps a Casperish friendliness, the humorous possibility that they might reappear with a boo or get busted by a proton pack. But no contact? Ever again? It seems so punitive, so final, so cold. And yet, maybe the healthiest thing you could do for yourself, urges Eamon Dolan in his persuasive new book, The Power of Parting. This byline piqued my interest immediately. Dolan is not your typical self-help author, a clinician or celebrity, other than in the hothouse world of Manhattan publishing, where he has edited big bestsellers, including Fast Food Nation and Mary L. Trump's Tell All About Her Uncle Donald. Indeed, he looked for professional writers to take on this subject before deciding with trepidation to do it himself, consulting psychologists, the thin research on estrangement, most of which focuses on reconciliation, and fellow survivors of ghastly upbringings. Dolan's childhood in the Bronx was Dickensian. His father, the eldest of 11, worked long hours at the phone company and was hardly around. He died at 63 from cigarettes and, I now realize, sadness, Dolan writes. His mother, Teresa, emerges as a classic villain. You only have one mother, she'd tell him, and he'd mutter, thank God. She regularly pummeled Eamon and his two siblings with a long-handled wooden spoon, sometimes announcing with delight that these beating sticks were on sale at Key Food. She actually fed them cold gruel. After 9-year-old Eamon pleaded to get accelerator racing cars for Christmas, she gave him an accordion, cruelly housed in an accelerator-sized box, then shamed him for not being grateful and demanded he learn to play the instrument for visitors. Heat and hot water were strictly rationed in the Dolan home. In adulthood, a proper shower is among the six pleasures he's able to name after his therapist requests a list of 10. Dolan grew up to be hypervigilant. When good things happen to him, he gets a kind of vertigo. Seeing a "you've got this" sign when running in the park, he thinks endearingly, "Whatever this is, I haven't got it." When he decided to major in English literature at his top choice college, his mother scoffed that it was useless. What are you going to do with that? Open an English store? Now he thinks, yeah, bitch, that's exactly what I did. Making a living publishing books is absolutely a triumph, and yet I was surprised to find this deeply literate man relying so heavily on jargon du jour, like toxic, gaslight, boundaries, and late capitalism. Dolan's beloved brother and ally, Tommy, made scapegoat of the family, died in a car crash in 1999. After Teresa succumbed to COVID in 2020, his sister, Jerry, proclaimed, "Ding dong, the witch is dead," and they laughed. But the matriarch had been disappearing from their lives long before that. after violating his carefully set out rules for engagement. The liberation he felt after cutting her off was, what's the opposite of intoxicating? Purifying. Dolan is a dad and husband himself, but he argues that Christianity has glorified the nuclear family to an unhealthy extent, given how many tormentors statistically are close relations, and implores for community safeguards. None of us should be imprisoned by the cosmic lottery that placed us in an abusive home, he writes. He points out that the only legal form of assault in any American state is, incredibly, hitting your child. Gen Xers with their latchkeys and rusty bicycles mock today's trend of gentle parenting, but the power of parting reminds that the norms of yesteryear were harsh to the point of harm, ignored by institutions and normalized in pop culture. Archie Bunker named his son-in-law Meathead. The Dolan kids were regularly called Amadan, Irish for fool. In the absence of sufficient atonement for such trespasses, Dolan suggests forgiveness is overrated, and in some cases, see ya, wouldn't want to be ya, is exactly what the doctor should order. One adult child visiting her brain-dead father after 15 years of not talking to him resumed contact with a bang. I punched him in the arm, she tells Dolan. I dug my fingers into his skin at one point. The power of parting is an intellectually rigorous manifesto, a green light for reasonable limits that sometimes, with gleeful, blunt force, flares red. The reviewer, Alexandra Jacobs, reviews all kinds of books, but is often drawn to life writing, which includes biography, memoir, letters, essays, and some fiction. The Ideological Brain, The Radical Science of Flexible Thinking, by Lior Smigrud. The book cover is blue, with eight parallel strands of yarn or string laid out in an S shape that is lying on its side. Two circles, a gold one at the bottom right and a blue one at the top left, mark the two ends of the meandering strings. The reviewer is Jennifer Zelai. This is Your Brain on Politics. A new book by the neuroscientist Lior Smigrud explores the connections between brain biology and political beliefs. There is a photo of a real human brain being held up to the camera by a gloved lab worker in scrubs. Having a one-track mind can feel pretty good. We possess beliefs, yes, but we can also become possessed by them, the neuroscientist Lior Smigrud writes in her lively new book, The Ideological Brain. We might talk a big game about freedom while also being terrified of the uncertainty that comes with it. It's only human to yearn for the clarity provided by a system that tells us how to think and what to do. Human brains soak up ideological convictions with vigor and thirst. Smigrud says she knows this because she has studied the connections between the brain biology and political ideology. She began her experiments in the months between the Brexit referendum in Britain and the 2016 presidential election in the United States. Using a method called the Wisconsin Card Sorting Test, she tracked how her subjects responded to a sudden and arbitrary change in the rules. She also surveyed research on the amygdala, the almond-shaped structure in each hemisphere of the brain that processes emotions, especially negative ones like fear and disgust. Conservatives, she says, often have larger amygdala. Yet figuring out which comes first, whether people with bigger amygdala are drawn to conservative ideologies or conservative ideologies make people's amygdala bigger, is an ongoing endeavor. The science, in other words, isn't settled. Indeed, the ideological brain turns out to have surprisingly little that is definitive to say about the ideological brain. Smigrud is an able guide through the thicket of scientific research, but her book necessarily includes a few, to be sure, paragraphs conceding that some of the most tantalizing findings haven't been replicated. The finest neuroscientific studies are built up slowly, iteratively, and thoughtfully, she writes, Warnings and cautious qualifiers are rarely riveting. Limits on our imagination seldom are, but they are intellectually honest. And intellectual honesty is ultimately what this book is about. Ideologues tend to be cognitively rigid, Zmig Rude said. Their resistance to changing their minds makes them slow to adapt to new information that challenges their priors. She cites research conducted by the psychologist Else Frankel Brunswick, who fled Austria after the Anschluss. Settling in Berkeley, California, Frankel Brunswick set out to learn how, as she put it, the ethnocentric child becomes a potential fascist. She found that parents who fostered imagination and empathy encouraged their children's cognitive flexibility. By contrast, parents who ruled with an iron fist produced children who welcomed the domination of others. For these children, all relationships were unequal and inherently abusive. They idolized strict fathers. Such worship was a way of justifying their own oppressions, the militarization of their imagination and desires. In other words, a rigid environment can make a mind more rigid, a finding that's not exactly earth-shattering, but Frankel Brunswick did notice something more unexpected. The children raised in overbearing households exhibited signs of both disintegration and rigidity. They were fascinated by chaos, upheaval, and catastrophe. They demanded order while also fetishizing disorder. Smigrud, in her own experiments, found something analogous. She invited 300 Americans to answer a questionnaire about their ideological worldviews and participate in a computer game that measured split-second decisions. Dogmatic participants struggled to piece together perceptual evidence efficiently, but they did not see themselves as sluggish thinkers. They reported loving thrills and making rash choices, Smigrud writes. A dogmatic person's low-level unconscious cognitive machinery is slower, but their high-level self-conscious personalities mean they make impulsive decisions. They will insist on law and order, yet also revel in burning the establishment down. It's this recklessness that distinguishes the right-wing extremist from the cautious conservative. But Smigrud repeatedly emphasizes that her interest is in the ideological brain, whether its politics are identifiable as left or right. About halfway through the book, she explains why, according to her findings, the most cognitively flexible individuals are nonpartisans who lean to the left. She insists that she isn't championing a centrist complacency or a diluted shrinking moderation, but she does make a case for a minimalist form of liberalism, which she defines as openness to evidence and debate. As exhortations go, this one is perfectly reasonable, if banal. Smigrud suggests that our understanding of ideology has itself become too ideological. She recounts the fascinating story of Count Antoine Louis-Claude de Stud de Tracy, a nobleman imprisoned during the French Revolution, who coined the term ideologie to denote what he hoped would be a legitimate science that would use objective methods to ascertain how humans generate beliefs. The ideologists envisioned a society that would encourage individuals to think critically. Yet Tracy's approach was derided by an array of detractors, including Napoleon Bonaparte, Karl Marx, and even America's founding fathers, whom Smigrud characterizes as relying too heavily on the notion of a communal identity. Ideology has committed the crime of centering reason and observation at the expense of collective myth and magical thinking, she writes. This original understanding of ideology, the dispassionate study of beliefs, has been lost to time and now conveys its opposite, a passionate commitment to beliefs. Ideologiste gave way to ideologue. Smigrud laments this turn. The last sentence in the ideological brain calls for a day when we might envision a mind that is ideology-free. It's an argument that is personal for Smigrud, who describes her own discomfort whenever anybody asks her where she is from. My grandparents grew up speaking one language, and my parents cultivated the slang of another, while I learned the grammars and nuances of entirely different scripts, she writes. We all came of age on different continents, hearts breaking under different skies, overlooking different seas, our secrets and curses whispered in different tongues. Smigrud is such an appealing writer that it's easy to glide over some of the knottier implications of her book. What happens when the flexible mind runs up against an autocracy? How does it react to a moral atrocity? Does it put up resistance? Or, in its infinite adaptability, does it acquiesce and go with the flow, however unjust? The non-ideological person strives towards intellectual humility, continuously being open to updating their beliefs in light of credible evidence, and balancing a healthy dose of skepticism against myth-making practices with a humanist sympathy toward those who feel compelled to engage with collective ideologies, she writes. All of this sounds really nice. I can see how we would be better off if every person on the planet was committed to intellectual humility and humanist sympathy. But I'm not sure that I needed a neuroscientist to tell me that. The reviewer, Jennifer Zelai, writes essays and reviews about nonfiction books, often with an eye to how they connect to our current moment. Heartwood by Amity Gage. The book cover has a path leading to the distant horizon, surrounded by a green canopy of tall leafy trees. The foliage of the trees cleverly forms a side view of a woman's head and long neck. The reviewer is Michelle Ruiz. A slow-burn thriller set on the Appalachian Trail. In Heartwood, when an experienced hiker named Valerie vanishes, other women must crack the case. In the long shadow of Cheryl Strayed's Wild, it borders on ambitious to write a book about a solo female hiker setting off on a long, prickly journey. Amity Gage does it anyway with Heartwood, a novelistic cousin to Strayed's best-selling 2012 memoir of tackling the Pacific Crest Trail after her mother's death. It's the story of three woodsy women, each lost in her own wilderness, and the gnarled roots between mothers and daughters. At the center of the story is Valerie Gillis, a nurse who goes missing in Maine during an audacious hike of the 14-state beast that is the Appalachian Trail. Her chapters are presented through the love letters, scrawled as increasingly desperate journal entries, that she writes to her mother, Janet, to pass the time and stay sane while she's stranded. Then there's Beverly Lieutenant Bev Miller, a veteran game warden who leads the search for Valerie while silencing calls about her own ailing ma. By far the most magnetic of the novel's interconnected trio is Lena Kucharski. She's a 76-year-old retired scientist who forages for fresh dandelions, among other edible flora and fauna, undeterred by her motorized wheelchair or the banality of the Connecticut retirement community where she now lives. Estranged from her daughter, Christine, a lonely Lena is free to turn a forensic eye to the Gillis case. Through Valerie's epistolary chapters, Gage reveals that the missing hiker was an obsessively clingy child, overly attached, to use modern family therapy lingo, who viewed her mother as practically mythic. Sometimes, in your lap, I would press my hand against your chest so that I could feel the center of you, your heartwood, your innermost substance, like the core of a tree that keeps it standing, Valerie recalls. A poet soul, Valerie fills her odes to Janet with lush detail, observing the infinite bosque of the forest, which is blanketed with leaves, layered together like phyllo pastry. Though Gage writes vibrantly about Valerie's setting, trees and more trees, a boreal hall of mirrors, Valerie herself is less vivid. She's meh about her loyal, or is he, husband, Gregory Bourras. But we don't really see her wrestling with whether or not to leave him and their saccharine surface-level marriage, a missed opportunity to infuse Valerie with vulnerability or a refreshing hint of ugliness. She's traumatized by nursing during COVID, but her pandemic backstory never feels as visceral as The Trail. And though Gage writes strikingly about realizing your mother is only human, no woman is a star, no woman is a god or a tree or a magician, Valerie never fully reckons with her idolization of Janet. Fortunately, Bev's jagged relationship with her mother proves more complex. Even after she became a pioneering female lieutenant, Bev still failed to win approval from her traditional ma, who considers wardenship unwomanly. "Do you wish to be a man?" Ma asks in a flashback. Nonetheless, Bev is married to her job, and she finds fulfillment in her stellar record of finding missing people. "The back country is my mother," she declares. Bev's an earthy heroine, one whom Gage imbues with just enough folksiness to be charming. A speech she makes to search volunteers, reminding them that it's not always who you'd bet on that makes it, is especially winning. The true heartwood of the novel, though, is Lena, an acquired taste and total delight in the vein of Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kittredge. Lena's senior life is rich with interest, from her virtual friendship with a younger man she meets in a foraging subreddit, they bond over black locust flowers which he eats like popcorn, to her real-life friendship with her fellow retirement community resident, Warren Esterman, who's clearly in love with her. A scientist to her core, she drives away Christine by treating her like a specimen, but Lena can't help herself. Looking at life through a microscope is her specialty. Lena is one of the novel's most gripping characters, and fittingly, Gage gives her one of the more surprising and satisfying arcs of the book. Heartwood absorbs the reader in the subculture and shorthand of the A.T., including Tramily, or Trail Family, the notion of Hiker Midnight, 9 p.m., and the use of trail names. Valerie goes by Sparrow, a nickname from her mother that she reframes during her many lonely hours. "Sparrows are survivors," she says. Her trail brother, Ruben Serrano, a.k.a. Santo, a Bronx-bred, self-described fat Dominican-American man, provides comic relief about the historic whiteness of backpacking. "There's this moment when they literally don't understand," he cracks of fellow hikers. "They're like, is that a person of color?" As the days pass and hope dwindles, Valerie fears an ominous he. Could it be Gregory or even the big-hearted Santo? Neither is a terribly convincing red herring. The mystery is mostly an afterthought. The real suspense of Heartwood is whether all three women will make it out of their metaphorical woods. The reviewer, Michelle Ruiz, is a contributing editor at Vogue. The following books are reviewed by Olivia Waite. Shattering Romance Novels with Glorious Payoffs. Fan Service by Rosie Dannon. Fan Service, published by Berkeley, introduces Devon Ashwood, who soared to youthful fame as the lead werewolf on a supernatural soap. Now he's a washed-up 42, hoping to drum up interest in a reboot. When he's caught on video running through L.A., sporting claws and howling at the full moon, everyone assumes it's a stunt or a breakdown. It's neither. Devon is suddenly an actual werewolf and has no idea what to do about it. His only hope is Alex Lawson, a vet tech and ex-moderator of a fan archive who carries a grudge against Devon after a long-ago encounter. She's snarky and dismissive. He's an ego monster with a terminal lack of self-awareness. Together, they're a nonstop disaster of sore spots, misunderstandings, an inconvenient but irresistible lust, and it is all such a good time. Dannon's one of the best at breaking your heart with a single sentence. Devon often observed normal families when he had the chance, trying to collect pieces of what it meant to be loved so that he could better play a son in future roles. Because as romance readers, we want to feel just as shattered and just as redeemed as the people on the page. A Gentleman's Gentleman by T.J. Alexander. Alexander's first Regency romance, A Gentleman's Gentleman, published by Vintage, is all shy emotion amid an orgy of historical menswear. Christopher Winterthrope, the orphaned Earl of Eden, must marry before his 25th birthday or lose his lands and title. Marriage is a complicated prospect since Christopher is trans. Determined to make a good show for prospective brides, Christopher asks his lawyers to send him a valet. And what a valet they find. James Harding is stern, hardworking, and unutterably handsome. Christopher is dazzled, but he doesn't believe love is a possibility for someone with his unique masculinity. The reader knows better and can spot the subtle early signs of James' affection before Christopher does. It's the most savory kind of anticipation, a very readerly having your cake and eating it too. The Love Simulation by Etta Easton. In The Love Simulation, published by Berkeley, the sequel to Easton's excellent The Kiss Countdown, the middle school vice principal Brianna Rogers is brutally strict about work and life boundaries, especially because the hot science teacher Roman Major is also the principal's son and a rival for Brianna's job. The elder Major has been vengefully thwarting Brianna at every turn, even redirecting her library funding to a new football field. So when Brianna finds a fellow teacher is putting together a team to do a simulated Mars mission for a cash prize, she sees a chance to get that library budget back. Unfortunately, Roman also ends up on the team. Brianna's sure Roman's there to sabotage her on his dad's orders, even though he insists otherwise. As simulated, Martian dangers and close quarters turn up the heat. It's up to the two of them to decide how much they can trust each other, and if they can be more to each other than merely colleagues. Easton's books are a blend of family tension and bubbly fun, with a spark of chemistry at their hearts. The reviewer, Olivia Waite, is the book reviewer's romance fiction columnist. She writes queer historical romance, fantasy, and critical essays on the genre's history and future. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.